I think it's Friday, the 21st, afternoon meeting of House Finance. It's 1:37. And with us so far today, we have Representative Kelly, Representative Foster, Representative Hocker, Co-Chair Meyer, and Co-Chair Chenal. While we don't have six at this time for a quorum to actually conduct official business, we will start with an overview from Revenue, Department of Revenue. With us today we have Bill Corbis, Commissioner, Tom Bowden, and Brett Fried.
Freed.
Okay. And also on teleconference we have Michael Williams, who is the Chief Petroleum Economist, and Dan Dickerson, who is the Director of the Tax Division. So, Commissioner, if you would, please come forward and give us your overview.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It was my understanding that we were supposed to present the fall revenue forecast, not a department overview.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
For the record, my name is Bill Corbis, Commissioner of Revenue. On my left is Deputy Commissioner Tom Butan. On my right is Brett Fried, economist. And present by telephone in Anchorage is Dan Dickinson, Director of the Tax Division, and Michael Williams, Chief of Petroleum Economist. And behind me we have Jerry Burnett, who is the Department of Revenue legislative liaison person. The outline for our presentation today, I'm going to hit the highlights on the fall revenue forecast. Dan Dickinson will review with you the process that the Department of Revenue follows in preparing the forecast. Brett Fried will discuss non-petroleum revenues, and we'll hear comments from Michael Williams on his views on the international oil markets. And finally, we'd be glad to answer any questions the committee may have. Let me say about the forecasting business that we in the Department of Revenue take this very seriously. It's an important part of our job. It's important to the legislature, and it's important to the administration. Many decisions are based upon our forecasts. And therefore, we put a lot of work in it and do everything we can to make them as accurate as possible. I'd like to make a slight sales pitch on the forecast booklet. That's this gray book that you have in front of you. There's a lot more information in this book than just what the projected revenues are going to be. There's a lot of data on independent corporations, on the investment performance of various state funds, and so on and so forth. I just would suggest to you that it's a handy document to have at your side. I can think of a lot of places that you can go for some of this information, big, thick financial reports, footnotes, and all that, but this is easy reading, and I highly recommend it to you. Just to quick and dirty review of the book itself, I would ask you to turn to the table of contents just to show you what we've got here. We have executive summary, which pretty well summarizes what we're going to be talking about today. Then every fall forecast, we have a feature story, if you will. And for this last fall, we selected ANWR. So you can there's a good quick and dirty summary of what ANWR might mean to the state of Alaska. Then the chapter 4 goes into more details on oil revenues. Chapter 5 reviews other non-oil revenues. Chapter 6, federal revenues. 7, investment income. 8 is a summary of state endowment funds. 9 is public corporations. And 10 is a Rosetta Stone, which is a chapter that reconciles the numbers in the revenue books with other state financial reports. And finally, Chapter 11, a series of appendices with a lot of useful data to be helpful in your work. In order to facilitate this discussion, you have in front of you a six-page document which has, we've made copies of the tables that we're going to be referring to that's included in the gray book. We hope that will make it a little easier for you to follow our presentations. Well, yesterday the price of oil for Alaska oil delivered to the West Coast was $40.79 a barrel. And the price per gas, natural gas, per million BTU in the New York Mercantile Exchange for Henry Hub gas was $6.25. Looking at our price projections for the next several years would be the first page of the six-page handout there. And for the year 2005, we're projecting the price of oil will be $43.61. This compares to $28.30, which we projected last spring. Quite a dramatic change. For fiscal year 06, we're projecting $34.50. And this compares with $25.85 last spring. For fiscal year 07, we're projecting $30.95 versus $22 last spring. And for the years 2008 through 2015, we're projecting oil at $25.50 per barrel. This is up $3.50 from the $22 that we were projecting last spring. OPEC has a stated policy of trying to maintain the price of oil between $22 and $28 per barrel. Historically, we have gone along with the low end of their range. However, this fall we went to the mid-range, to the $25.50, rather than the $22, which had been our posture in the past. We are less certain than we used to be that OPEC is going to stick to the $22 to $28 range. There have been statements in the press that they are reevaluating that and that we might be looking at a new range coming down the road. And we are watching the press reports on this with interest. Maybe Michael Williams will comment on that. It has certainly been a wild ride in the last several months as far as the price of oil is concerned. Actually, the numbers that are in the fall forecast were decided upon at a meeting in late October. At that time, the price of oil was over $50. Shortly after the meeting was over, we had an $18 drop over a 49-day period, which is rather spectacular. However, if you look back into history, maybe the drops of that magnitude are not so unusual. For instance, there was a $15 drop over a 48-day period in 2003. The run-up in the price was caused by the anticipation of the second Iraqi war. And in 1991, over a 37-day period, we had a $15 drop related to the first Iraqi war. The price today is approximately $41, $7 more than it was 5 weeks ago. So you can see that projecting prices is a sort of a dicey business. Volatility has occurred in the past, as I've just illustrated to you, and there's no reason to think it will not continue in the future. We've had somewhat of a change in certain relationships between the various prices of oil. When we do our forecast, we base price of oil initially on the value of West Texas Intermediate, which is probably the most commonly quoted price of oil or trading area for oil in the United States. However, Alaska sells its or its oil is sold to the West Coast. And so there is a differential, and historically there has been fairly constant relation between the price of West Texas Intermediate and the price of West Coast of oil delivered to the West Coast. For some reason, and Mike and Dan Dickinson will explain this in more detail, but that. That relationship is not holding as strong as it has in the past, and again, this makes our ability to predict the price of oil more difficult. We'll hear more from factors that affecting the volatility of oil from Michael Williams. Let's talk about production. If you were to go to the second page, table 2-6, you'll see that we are estimating 934,000 barrels of oil per day for fiscal year 2005. Looking to the future, we expect that the commencement of production for Point Thompson is going to be delayed as compared to what we had in the spring forecast, and that production will be accelerated from NPRA and from West Sac. And by the year 2013, we're looking at production averaging 919,000 barrels per day. By 2011, we expect that 48% of oil that is produced will come from new sources. That's from fields or wells that are not currently online. They're either being developed now or they are under consideration by, under evaluation by the industry to be developed. Turning to total unrestricted revenues, please refer to third page, table 2-2. We're looking for fiscal year 2005. We're projecting revenues of $2.98 billion. This compares with our spring estimate of $1.96 billion, up $1 billion. And it compares with $2.36 billion that we experienced for fiscal year 2004. For 2006, we are looking at revenues of $2.3 billion. Most of the differences in revenues for these respective years is price related. Based on the fall revenue forecast for fiscal year 05 of $2.98 billion, we are projecting a surplus of $653 million for 05, assuming that our $2.33 billion budget is adopted and the average price of oil of $43.61. The outlook for the constitutional budget reserve maintaining a positive balance has improved since the spring. I refer you to page 4, table 2-9. We are now predicting that it will last until February 2011. Last spring, we were predicting it would run out by May of 2008. A couple of things I wanted to bring to your attention. Figure 2-6, that's page 5 of the handout, is a graph illustrating the dwindling ELF factor as time goes on, which will result in the erosion of production taxes. This graph was prepared, and this forecast was prepared before the recently announced administrative decision consolidating a number of the production units into one unit for severance tax purposes. As I mentioned to you earlier, Chapter 3 is a special section on ANWR. I invite you to read that at your convenience. In conclusion, current and projected oil prices are very favorable to times gone by. Yet, the state still has a long-range structural financial problem that needs to be addressed. Matching reoccurring revenues with reoccurring expenses, ultimately that issue must be resolved. I refer you to the last page of the handout, table 2-8, which shows that looking to the future that we're going to be spending more money than we are receiving in revenues, and that somehow that problem must be corrected. Oil price volatility will continue. This forecast projects oil at the price of $43.61 for fiscal year 05. That was prepared last October. As it turns out, the average price for oil so far in fiscal year 05 has been $41.83, or we're about $1.78 per barrel under what we projected. Keep in mind, last spring we were projecting $28.30. At this juncture, it appears that we were a little optimistic. for the price of oil for fiscal year 05. Based on the average price of oil we've received for the year, the fiscal year to date, and then taking the price which the futures curves tells us that oil would be selling at for the remainder of the year, we are now estimating that we will be $154 million less than the projections included in the fall forecast. It's of interest to note that we made a similar presentation to the House Ways and Means Committee a week ago, and at that time we were projecting that we were going to be $187 million less. So you can see how things jump around. The fiscal year 05 forecast does not include any additional revenues which will be received from the administrative ruling on ELF. When we think about the possibility that revenues for 05 will be less than projected in the forecast based on futures information, keep in mind that the outlook for futures outlook for fiscal year 06 is quite a bit higher than the 34.50 that we are projecting right now. The next update to the Department of Revenue forecast will be in April of this year. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Dan Dickinson, who will give us a brief rundown on the process that we follow for projecting oil prices, oil production, and oil revenues. Dan?
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner. Before we get to Dan, I would like to acknowledge that Representative Joe and Representative Stoltz have joined us. And so we do have a quorum to operate efficiently and officially.
Can we ask questions as going on?
You bet, Representative Joe.
Thank you. Commissioner,
good afternoon. Good to see you.
The comment was, in the past, your projections were kind of at the low end of what OPEC was projecting. And then you've made a switch in that those projections to mid-range for future projections. But you had a statement there that says, you know, you're not trusting OPEC's projections in the future. So I'm wondering how you can go from low to mid-range and then not be trusting the projections that OPEC is going to be. Is that because you're not trusting them in that they're going to be higher, or is just things so volatile? And how do we find comfort level in going to the middle?
Through the chair, Representative Jewell, OPEC has made statements that they are considering reevaluating that 22 to 28 price range. And I guess you would say we're sort of anticipating that. I think when we hear from Michael Williams, he might be talking a little bit about that.
And one other follow-up, if I may. On page 2 of this shorter handout, in terms of new oil and when it comes online, I'm just wondering what's here, because I haven't had a chance to go over that chapter 3, when you would see ANWR coming online, and is it factored into this table?
ANWR, through the chair, Representative Jewell, ANWR is not included in this table. The full impact of ANWR would not be felt until after 2020.
Thank you.
Dan Dickinson, are you there?
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Bill's asked me to make a couple of comments about how we do our forecast, and I guess I'll just say that having to put out a forecast every 6 months and having two teenage daughters makes me know I'm always wrong. It's not a question of whether I'm right, it's just how wrong are we? And what we try to do is we get a bunch of smart people together, folks from DNR, from UAA, OMB, DOR, folks from legislative finance sit in, although they don't actually participate in the vote, but we get a bunch of people together who have thought about these issues, and we present them with a whole lot of material. We look at historical distributions. We have an economist who looks at storage and inventory issues and gives us a presentation on those. We look at fundamental shifts. Brett, who's there with the commissioner, gives us a presentation every 6 months. It's called an AREMA model, which is an autoregressive integrated moving average model. And if you have any questions, I suggest you probably should ask Kim about those. We look at what the IEA is forecasting for global supply and demand. We look at what OPEC is saying. We look at International Monetary Fund projections. We look at the straight price projections that come from CIRA, who's a consultant that I believe the legislature has used in the past. We look at the NYMEX futures curve, what people are buying and selling oil for delivery in the future. We look at the Department of Energy, who actually puts out forecasts. We put all this together, we make the presentations, people ask questions, there's a lot of back and forth, and we basically create two scenarios, two paths for where we think is going to affect price formation over the next three-year period. And then we simply take a vote. The people who've been sitting there, each person, some people put a great deal of emphasis in the dollar forecast, some are, some folks are trained other ways, put a lot of focus on inventory, whatever. But the point is, we have a lot of people from a lot of viewpoints. We take those and we sort of use the mathematics of creating an average to come up and say, here's our best guess of that price path over the next 3 years. We go through a similar process for the long-term forecast, but we also have an added wrinkle, and that is for the long-term forecast, we only change it if we've had two consecutive sessions in which we've agreed it should be changed and in the direction it should be changed. So one of the things we don't want to do, because so many people use these numbers to wrestle with the issues that I know that a lot of you are, well, that you will be facing and that Bill talked about, which is, what is the state's finances going to look like in 5 years or 10 years or 15 years? What is it going to look like before a gas line or before Anwar comes on? We don't want to be changing those long-term numbers a lot based on sort of what news we've heard recently. We've noticed, and we're not the only ones who do this, that we have a tendency when prices are high to over-forecast. I think they'll continue to be too high. When prices are low, we tend to be pessimistic and low. So we only change that long-term forecast if we've had 2 years in which we've said we would. We last changed it last year. So in our fall forecast 10 months from now, again, those same folks will say, should we consider changing it next year? And if they say yes, and a year from then they agree it should be changed, then we'll change it. But that's basically how we put together the price numbers. As Bill said, we do that back in October so that we can quickly generate a number which is then used as the governor writes his budget. We usually don't publicly announce that number until sometime later in November and December, and usually by then people can already point out how wrong we are. But if you look at page 10 in the books that you have there, you'll see that's the product of what we come up with. It's simply a series of prices for West Texas Intermediate. The second item we have to estimate is, how is ANS going to be priced relative to West Texas Intermediate? And when we make our estimates there, we look at a lot of things. Historically, we haven't focused on that a lot because that's moved around between, $1.50 and $2. It hasn't been a huge factor given the overall accuracy of what we do. But what's happened in the last 6 months, which is extraordinary, is that differential has moved up to about $6. In other words, we find ANS trading at about a $6 discount to WTI. And that's something that has us concerned because, you know, for example, if you look at our forecast, we actually had a very accurate forecast of WTI. What we missed was the fact that ANS would be trading at such a discount to it. One of the items that I don't know if this has been handed out or Jerry Burnett has these, but I prepared a graph, and is that available, or is the graph that says differences in crude oil prices compared to WTI?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What this shows is that ANS is not the only crude to suddenly over the last 6 months to suddenly show a new price relationship to WTI. And what I want to show here, the red squares are ANS, and you can see, as I said, that it bounced around but basically stayed north of $2, and you can extend this back many years and you can see that same relationship. Suddenly, this fall, that gap widened. The point I wanted to make with this slide is there are a number of crudes, and they tend to be the sour crudes like ANS, that had their differentials move much more dramatically, things that might have been trading at a $4 or a $6 discount to WTI suddenly found themselves trading at a $16 or $18 discount to WTI. And, of course, during the 1980s, for example, if you were trading an $18 discount to WTI, you'd have to give somebody a barrel of oil and then give them a dollar. I mean, these are just unheard of discounts. When Michael speaks to you, maybe he can talk a little bit more about some of the reasons that people are positing this is going to happen. I think it's safe to say that when they posit that, they don't see. There still is some question about whether we're going to and when we're going to return to more historical norms in the relationship between WTI and ANS. So that's how we do prices. The other important component that we have to put into our model that models all the state's revenues and turns it into a revenue number is the volume. And if you turn to page 12 of the books that you have, you will see how we have forecast the volume. What we do here is we do a build-up from the bottom. Now, that's what you see here. Looks like a nice, smooth graph. But what we're doing is we're looking at about 30 different producing areas, calculating each one, and then add them together and see what happens. In the graph on the top of page 12, you'll see that we divide the producing areas or the production into three categories. The first one, and the largest one, is simply producing fields now. The major fields, Prudhoe Bay, Kuparuk, Alpine, North Star, we're all familiar with those. And for those, we have off-the-shelf software that oil companies use. It's a program called Oil Field Manager. You plug in a number of sort of recent historical data and some reservoir characteristics, and it basically spits out a production curve, and then you can make some adjustments to that based on what you understand or what we believe companies are making for investments. The other two areas, the darker grays, are production that's going to come, well, the darkest gray is going to be production that comes from current development, money that's being spent now, plumbing that's being hooked up now. And that we're a little more certain of. We're still making estimates. We're still actually taking the investors' estimates, and kind of working them, trying to make sure we understand them. So we put those in. And then the last category is stuff under evaluation, and there we really are, again, going from what the companies say. There we take that with a little more grain of salt. But these are projects that are under seeking sanction, where they're trying to get the investment going. We create these, we run them by our colleagues in the Department of Natural Resources. Frequently a spirited discussion ensues, but generally I think we actually are fairly close. And our projections here, we're generally within a percent or so. For example, This year, we are forecasting in this fiscal year that production would average 935,000 barrels a day. Right now, we're estimating a little bit less than that, 923,000 barrels a day. The difference of about 12,000 barrels a day, which is something, let's call it 4 million barrels for the year. A lot of that occurred because we had a very bizarre period in early January when the temperatures on the North Slope were 30 degrees above normal, where it's normally 20 or 15 below. It was 10 or 15 above. And when you have warmer temperatures, compressors aren't as efficient, so you can't handle as much gas, and so you don't get as much oil out of the ground. So we had a sort of a very bizarre situation there in early January. That's corrected itself, and so we're within a 12,000 barrels a day, which is a very small number. In our sources book, we divide the world up into sort of four areas of revenues. I've just talked about the models that we use to generate the oil revenues. There's a federal number, which is also a very large number, which we get our estimates from OMB. There's investment numbers. We get those from Callan Associates and the Permanent Fund. And then there's other revenues, other general fund revenues, and I'm going to turn that over to Brett Freed to speak about those. I'm certainly available for any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Dan. And I believe Representative Meyer had a question.
Actually, my question is for the Commissioner, so I'll wait till I roll the presentation.
Any other questions from Dan? Commissioner?
I'd like to turn it over to Brett Freed, who's going to talk about other revenues. Brett?
If the committee could turn to page 37, forecast from. I'm just going to briefly go over the other revenues, and this table 5.1, gives the overview for the other revenues, and they're broken up just like all the other revenues into unrestricted and restricted.
Representative Kelly?
This one anyway isn't paginated, so I can't track it. Can you maybe tell me what the chapter and then how many pages?
Yes, it's five right here. So, you don't have any page numbers there?
Right.
Right.
Yes, they're small. A little bit of letters there.
That EA 25 thing?
Yeah, they're real faint on the bottom here, on the right-hand side. Oh, it's in the actual revenue sources book.
He's in the right book.
Yeah, oh, okay.
Very bottom. Maybe they have
new glasses.
I think it's the cut.
I'm going to go real briefly. The unrestricted and restricted revenues are broken down into different categories. We break them into the taxes, so that would be all the non-oil taxes, the charges for services, fines, and forfeitures, so that would be criminal and civil penalties. It would be settlements that are non-oil settlements, licenses and permits, rents and royalties, which would be all the non-oil rents and royalties, and then other is categories that didn't fit into any of these categories up here. And then I wanted to turn to the tax portion of this and just go through it very, very briefly. And that is on page 41. It's table 5.2. And if you look at the top there, and we just take the first one, the alcoholic beverages tax, you'll see that we have as an actual $16.3 million, and then we've projected for fiscal year 05 at $15.9 million, for fiscal year 06 at $15.9 million. But that's just for the unrestricted general fund. Then if you drop down to restricted, you'll see under the alcohol beverages that we also have the 16.3, 15.9, 15.9. That's because 50% of the revenue from the alcohol beverage taxes goes into this fund called the Alcohol and Other Drug Abuse Treatment and Prevention Fund. And the forecast
here, actually, we're forecasting out level. This was just a change, the difference in FY04 is just a change in the method we use for accrual. If you go to the second, if you just go down and look at cigarettes, you'll see we have, as an actual for fiscal year 04, we have $9.4 million. For FY05, $14.9 million. And FY06, we have $27.1. But again, that's just part of the story. That's what we include under the unrestricted general fund. But if you go under restricted, you have to look under cigarette school fund because as some of the revenue goes into the school fund. And then also, starting January 1, 2005, some of the revenue goes into the tobacco education use and cessation fund. The reason for the increase in the cigarette tax revenue is the tax rate on cigarettes went up from $1 to $1.60 January 1, 2005. So this month it went up by 60 cents a pack. And then if we just move down and look at the corporate income tax, just because it's interesting because we have forecasted out a large change in the corporate income tax, so a change of over $10 million. This is for a lot of different factors, but one is that an act called the Job Creation and Workers Assistance Act of 2002, it changed the way taxpayers, how far back they can carry their net operating losses. It changed from 2 to 5 years. The bottom line on it is it increased the number of refunds that people could take in FY03 and FY04. That's over now, so we're moving back towards an average on the corporate income taxes. The other one I wanted to mention was fish taxes, really just to point out once again that you have the unrestricted revenue under the fish taxes, and then we include shared tax revenue under restricted. If you look at fisheries business tax, you see that we have $14.9 million in FY04 and then $12.5 going out. And then if you look under the restricted, you see the share, which is $14.4 for all the years going out. That's really all I have on other taxes, unless there's some questions.
Representative Stoltz.
Yeah. I have a question on the motor fuel tax. I'm kind of surprised it's gone down because the roads I'm on don't seem any less congested. Unless the mayor of Anchorage's carpooling plan is wildly successful, I guess. I wonder if you have any rationale why it dropped so much.
Well, actually, the motor fuel tax revenue, the reason why it's so high in 04 is because we received assessments from previous years. So it's not that you're getting more motor fuel use. It's a reflection of revenue coming in from previous years on assessments. We had a big assessment that year, and that's why you have the higher revenue now.
I know I did my part on that one this last year.
Representative Hawker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Back to the tobacco taxes, we all know about the last session's bill increase in tax rates. But 2 years ago, we passed the tax stamp legislation to aid your folks in enforcement of existing taxes. That, if I recall right, that had a pretty material, fairly material negative fiscal note, or positive revenue source. Have you factored any of that in? Well, number one, has that come true? Or two, has that factored into any of these numbers?
Up through the chair, Representative Hawker, it's not really factored into these forecasts. But what I will say is that started January 1, 2004. It went into effect. We are seeing more revenue in FY04. Of course, we can't be sure what the source of that revenue is. In other words, revenue came down after we passed the cigarette tax. The number of taxable cigarettes that were sold went down. Then last year, then it leveled off, and then this last year it bumped up some. So it's possible that that has to do with tobacco stamp, and maybe in the future we're going to see with more enforcement, we're going to see more revenue. We've got, of course, now another big change, which is the 60-cent increase in the tax rate. But no, it's not built into these numbers.
Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you.
Moving on, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to introduce Michael Williams, Dr. Michael Williams, who is Chuck Logston's replacement. As you know, Chuck retired. Michael has only been on the job six working day on the job. I'm sorry he could not be here to meet you, but I'm sure that you will eventually all get a chance to know him personally. Michael, I wonder if you could just briefly give us a little picture of your background and then talk to us about the volatility, international oil markets, so forth.
Okay, Bill, thank you very much for that introduction, and Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'll just start off with a synopsis about myself, and then I'll talk a little bit about the international oil markets, and then I'll talk a little bit about volatility. I received my PhD in economics from the University of Colorado in Boulder, where my dissertation was titled An Evaluation of Alternative Uses of Alaskan Natural Gas. Although my dissertation was completed in 1983, the topic seems very timely today. My career has spanned several industries, but I have over 15 years in the oil and gas industry. Previous positions I have held include being an economic advisor to the Saudi Arabian Minister of Finance, an economist at Marathon Oil Company, and a principal administrator with the International Energy Agency in Paris, France. In addition, I have run my own consulting company. I've written 4 books on energy, numerous articles on energy, contributed to a large number of energy publications, and delivered presentations at conferences worldwide. Being as the chief of economist for the state of Alaska is an exciting opportunity for me as I look forward to providing the state with useful information to help it make informed decisions. Next, I'd just like to touch on the international oil markets a bit. And if we look at the demand side, the International Energy Agency in Paris is predicting worldwide oil demand will grow about 1.4 million barrels a day, or 1.7% in 2005. Most likely, China will show the largest percent gain, and at least one organization, ABM AMRO, predicts growth of about 9% in 2005. By contrast, by the way, China's oil demand grew about 16% in 2004. On the supply side, many nations are planning to expand their crude oil production capacity. According to Petroleum Intelligence Weekly, Kuwait plans to expand production by about 100,000 barrels a day. United Arab Emirates plans to expand crude oil production capacity by about 200,000 barrels a day. And Iran is planning to expand by about 90,000 barrels a day. Saudi Arabia expanded production capacity in 2004, but has no plans for 2005. Outside of OPEC, Brazil plans to expand production capacity by about 382,000 barrels a day. That's a whopping 25%. Russia plans to expand production by about 359,000 barrels a day, or 4%, while the U.S. production is expected to expand by about 293,000 barrels a day, or 5.4%. In part, the U.S. increase comes about because the platforms in the Gulf of Mexico resume production. Now, some have questioned whether Russia can actually increase its crude oil production by that much, especially given the political problems the state oil company has been experiencing. In addition, OPEC has been discussing a higher price ceiling, and there is still the potential for OPEC to reduce crude oil production during the second quarter of 2005. Thus, we see growing oil demand at a time where there is tightness on the supply side. One might consider the current setting that of a seller's market, in which demand appears to be growing faster than supply, which causes prices to increase or to be firm. Now, before I go on to volatility, I'd like to just touch on the differentials topic, which Dan was discussing, and I want to relate that to something that I said. Now, if you recall, Dan said differentials remained fairly constant until the fall of last year. And I'd like to draw your attention to the fact that we had some hurricanes in the Gulf of Mexico. Those hurricanes actually knocked out a lot of the production platforms. Those production platforms tended to produce crude oil that was very light, very sweet, low sulfur. It was high-valued crude oil. Well, the market needed additional crude oil, so heavier crude oils were brought forth from the Middle East. And so during this time, we saw the prices for higher crude oils go up more than the prices for the lower crude oils, and this is what caused the differential to expand. And of course, I'll use that to lead me right into price volatility, and I'd like to talk about a few ideas. Now, in my discussion of volatility, I'm going to talk about day-to-day changes. I know Bill has already talked about some changes over 48 days or 37 days, but I want to focus on the daily changes. Now, for example, the closing price for Alaska North Slope on January 3rd of this year was $36 per barrel. On January 4th, the next day, the closing price was $37.79. This represents an increase of $1.79 per barrel, or 5% in one day. It is the daily percent change that I'm going to focus on. Some days prices go up, and some day prices go down. The daily changes I'm going to discuss are the absolute changes. So if the price increases 5% one day, and then it decreases 5% the next day, the average price change is still 5%. These are absolute changes I'm discussing. Now, the daily changes for January 2005 have averaged about 1.9%. And you've got to keep in mind there are still 7 days left in the month. So far in January, there have been 6 days when prices increased, 6 days when prices decreased, and one day where there was no change. On average, the price changes average 77 cents per barrel per day, or 1.9% a day. Now, you might be wondering how this compares with previous years. Well, in January 2004, the average daily change was 1.8%, and for January 2003, it was 2.3%. As you can tell, this month's volatility is similar to the volatility found in January and earlier years. So now you might ask, what is the cause of this volatility? And my answer to that, it is people's perception of the future. And I'm going to say that again. It's people's perception of the future and how they respond to their perspective. Now, this comes about because people learn about an event on the internet, they read about it on the newspaper, they see it on television, or they talk to someone. When these individuals receive this information, they take action. For example, if an independent refiner learns that a hurricane in the Gulf of Mexico destroyed some crude oil production platforms, the individual will purchase some crude oil on the open market to ensure his refinery has enough crude oil to operate. It is numerous individuals taking independent actions in response to an event that changes crude oil prices and causes volatility. Yesterday online in the FinancialTimes.com, the following paragraph was written. The U.S. Energy Information Administration reported a rise in crude oil stocks of 3.4 million barrels for the week ending January 14. The March contract for Brent stood at $44.09 per barrel in mid-morning trade on the International Petroleum Exchange, down 62 cents on the previous session's close. So we see people take action in response to events that are reported, such as wars, hurricanes, explosions, and such. And people also take action in response to press releases, especially from organizations such as the U.S. Department of Energy, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, the International Energy Agency, or the American Petroleum Institute. Now, for a moment, I want you to think about the worldwide oil system. This includes crude oil production, transportation, refining, inventories, and distribution of refined products. There are many parts to the puzzle, and they are located in over 200 countries. If there is plenty of spare crude oil production capacity, extra tankers, calm seas, adequate inventories, and calm weather, then there's a fairly stable system. But that is not the situation we face. In fact, there is very little spare crude oil production capacity at the same time that the International Energy Agency is predicting the demand for oil will grow by 1.7% in 2005. This is stressing the worldwide system, and you might consider our system a just-in-time delivery system. As we look around the globe, we see there's political volatility in a number of oil-producing countries, such as Nigeria, the Soviet Union, and Iraq, and there are weather problems in certain parts of the world that have disrupted the world oil system. Looking forward, therefore, I expect volatility to continue as it did in 2004. bulk of the issues that caused volatility in 2004 have not disappeared. These include a lack of spare production capacity, a lack of spare refining capacity, and a relatively low product inventories. Whether there is greater volatility in 2005 compared to 2004 is something I cannot predict with accuracy. I do believe, however, crude oil prices will remain volatile. And just as a side note, for every dollar change in the price of ANS, this translates to a difference of about $55 million for Alaska state revenues. These conclude my remarks, and I will attempt to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Any questions? Seeing none, back to you, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, that completes our presentation. We're all available to answer questions.
Thank you. Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Commissioner and Mr. Rester, for coming out today. Is it safe then to say that the new windfall projection is about $500 million? Because I think the governor, at least in the January 11th book that he gave us on the budget, had forecasted about a $650 million windfall, and you're saying it's now been revised about $150 million. So $500 million, give or take. Is that correct? At least today,
Mr. Chairman, I am reluctant to say revised projection. The estimate as of today is that we're going to be $154 million below, and so that would make $500, but that's changing daily.
Changes daily, I understand. Okay. Yeah, I won't hold you to that number. I just want to make sure we're in the ballpark together here. And normally, every year, and I know this will be our third year together, revenue or the governor's office comes out with some new revenue measures. Now, obviously, the governor came out with one last week that none of us knew about, changing the boundaries of the Prudhoe Bayfield. But is there any other revenue ideas that you have for this session that you're going to want us to work on, whether it be a tobacco tax, alcohol tax, POV?
The governor in his State of the State speech mentioned alcohol taxes. That is being evaluated. I couldn't say for sure whether that will be introduced or not, but it's being given serious consideration. As far as the POMV goes, as you're aware, the administration heavily supported the POMV during the last session. In fact, the governor went so far as to call a special session to ask the legislature to address that. As far as the administration is concerned, the POMV is on the table for your consideration. We invite you to continue to work on that. If you can think of a better way making POMV work, we'd be interested in any your proposal, and any other way of taking advantage of the permanent fund to help resolve our long-term fiscal problem.
Okay, I appreciate that. And maybe before we get away too, we can address the Amerita Hess and using the dividends from that fund for some of the capital projects that the governor's proposing, $350 million worth of capital projects using that funding. But that's a separate question. I think if I recall the governor's State of the State speech, he didn't specifically say alcohol taxes, but he said an increase in fines, I think, for DWI or something like that. But it had to do with alcohol. That's correct.
That's right.
I'd like to say that I think you and your staff do an excellent job on oil forecasts. I mean, you do just as well as anybody else. I mean, if anybody knew how to do it accurately, we certainly wouldn't be here. So my hat's off to you on that. But And that's an area we can't control. I mean, obviously, Saudi Arabia, drop of the hat, can change the price of oil up and down significantly. But one thing that we can control, to some extent, is oil production. What are we doing, if anything, to help increase oil production in the state? And I'm wondering, with the administrative order to change the calculation of the ELF on the marginal fields around Prudhoe Bay, if that's going to affect some future production at, say, the Kuparuk Alpine fields or even NPRA, because I think we've all been hearing from some of the oil companies this week that they're a little grumpy that the governor changed, by administrative order, changed their tax structure. You know, they justify these projects based on a certain tax rate, and when that changes, that obviously makes their economics different than what they had forecasted. And so I think, at least what they're telling me, and I don't know about some of the others, but now on these new fields, they're going to use the highest tax rate, because again, by administrative order, the governor can do to some of these other fields what he's done to the marginal fields around Prudhoe Bay. So I'm wondering if you've had a chance to factor in how that's going to impact future production, because I think you said by 2011 that you're anticipating almost 50% of the oil to come from new fields, which also would mean that if they're coming on board in 2011, that the company should be exploring now. And if I recall, there's really only one oil company exploring at the current time, that's ConocoPhillips. Now, there was some good news about NPRA, but, and maybe you can explain that to me too, because my understanding is the state's share from NPRA is much less than if it's on the eastern side over by Prudhoe and Anwar, and hopefully Anwar will get open. So anyway, I've thrown a lot of ideas out here to you, and I guess they all boil down to production and what we're doing to try to increase production in the future, because obviously we cannot, we all know, control the price of oil.
I think on several other fronts, Mr. Chairman, this administration has been heavily supportive of the oil industry to help them increase production. The permitting side of things, we're trying to build roads to make access better. We have session before last, we introduced the tax credit. As far as this ELF administrative ruling goes, I don't want to say that, make a statement that, that, you know, sometime in the future you may have to go against that or something, but we felt that the situation at Prudhoe Bay was a unique situation, and we are at least for the force right now, that's what the only change that we see coming.
Commissioner, this is Dan Dickinson. If I could add two comments to your answer.
Please, Dan, go ahead.
Representative Myers, through the chair. As you're aware, and as Bill mentioned, and many of you in this room, in that room, voted for, there we introduced a tax credit available to folks doing exploration. We actually, I think at the moment, have five companies that are doing exploration that will qualify under that program that we're looking at now. Normally that would be taxpayer confidential information, but one of them, we're about to write a press release because we just issued the first set of credits, but the, you know, it's Kerr McGee. So there are at least five companies out there doing exploration, certainly among the much of that on the North Slope. The other observation I wanted to make was, I think you're quite right that companies like to know what their taxes are going to be before they invest. We recognize that's very important. Consequently, the department has a regulation that it introduced that said you can apply to the department for an advance ruling. And just like a letter ruling from the IRS, this will allow you to understand beforehand what the tax treatment will be, and then allow you, you know, you can get that ruling before you invest a penny. Well, you've probably done some preliminary work, but before you make a major investment. Again, I think it's important to know that that tool is out there. The industry has used that. We have made advance rulings saying we wouldn't aggregate certain areas. This ruling does not contradict any of those. You know, we simply hadn't ruled on the particular set of aggregations that were done in this administrative ruling. But that tool is available, and we certainly expect before companies make any further investments, they will come and make sure they have those, because as you correctly observed, no one you know, likes to make a set of investment assumptions and then have them turn out to be wrong. An important part of that, of course, the biggest assumption they're going to make when they make any investments is price. And one of the things that we've certainly seen is that over the last 5 years, if an investment would have paid off at a low stress price, it's going to be paying off quite handsomely over the kind of prices we've seen since 1999. So as you observe, there's lots of things we can't control, and those can often make an investment much more attractive if it's been evaluated at a low stress price. There are things we can control, and we do that with those advanced rulings.
Good. Well, I appreciate that. This latest administrative ruling or administrative order that the governor has proposed, I haven't seen it. I don't know if some of the members on this committee have seen it, but I am told there's a couple things in there that's a little unclear. One is that it's retroactive, or can be retroactive, and the second is that it included the Orion field, which is, my understanding, a heavy oil field. And I think in his speech, he said that the heavy oil would be excluded. And I guess that concerns me just from the standpoint that I think heavy oil is going to be a factor in our future revenue and production, especially at the West Sac Group.
Mr. Chairman, we're aware of this heavy oil issue, and we have are available to meet with the owners of those fields to discuss that, and they have administrative remedies to that they can follow to ask us to re-examine.
Okay, good. Well, I appreciate that. And then at what point in time will we start booking this additional revenue? I mean, because it's a fairly significant amount, anywhere between, I'm told, $100 and $150 million.
Mr. Chairman, we would expect to start accruing that or receiving those revenues immediately.
February 1st?
Yes.
So we'll have a revised...
Excuse me, Dan, is it February 1st?
Mr. Chairman, certainly if we were accruing them, it would be February 1st. The actual payments, there's a one-month delay so that the checks that actually include that won't show up until the very end of March. So your February taxes will be include the aggregation, and that payment will be made the last day of March.
Okay, good. Well, I appreciate that, and I think we all share as a finance committee and as the Revenue Commission that we're so heavily dependent on one source of income, and with this change in and the Prudhoe Bay boundaries probably makes us now, I don't know, 90% dependent on one source. And I think that we need to work hard to try to diversify it, because as we know, is that one source of income, as the price of oil goes down, it impacts us, was it $70 million for $1 price of, is it fixed price? Okay. Anyway, it's a significant amount every time the price of oil changes every dollar, so. And I know you're supportive of the PLB and looking at other majors, so I appreciate that. And again, I think you're doing an excellent job on the oil forecast. And I will have a question then later on the MR of the HES. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Representative Short. Looking through on the revenues, I've had a hard time finding the section of business licenses in there and Gimlin's an increase. I thought that would have had its own narrative, as some of the others do. Has it met all the expectations on increases in revenue, or maybe give us some even anecdotal information on, as if we've been through about a year or so now of it, and with the 2-year renewal, we should at least have partial information on
rates of renewals or how many people are not renewing, and just given there was the percentage increase was pretty significant, three digits, and just maybe you can give us some analysis on that.
Through the chair, I'd like Brett Freed to answer that.
I believe it's in charges for services.
Mr. Chair, if I can just jump in, it's on, okay. On page 42, footnote 2 specifically talks about the DCED business licenses.
Can I jump in there for a second? In order to answer your question in terms of whether the increase meets expectations, I don't know that at this time, but I certainly can get back to you with that information.
It's an issue I've heard a lot about. Was it a tripling? And I voted for it, and I must have been sick that day or something, or should have been. Tripling it doesn't increase the revenues, and it's causing other effects. I sure want to know that, so maybe we can readdress the policy. So as good of information as possible. I appreciate the whole task of trying to forecast revenues. Kind of reminds me of Yogi Berra. They asked him what time it is. He said, "What do you mean now?"
Representative Hawker.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, in replying earlier to Representative Myers' questions, you characterized the percent of market value proposal as a revenue-raising mechanism. I, quite frankly, spent a lot of time on that bill last year, and as I recall, it had nothing to do with raising revenues. It was a device to protect the long-term value of the permanent fund. I was wondering if you might want to clarify your answer on that. Maybe you've got a new PMD proposal that does raise revenue for the state.
through the chair, you're right. The POMV is for the protection of the value of the permanent fund, but it does open up opportunities to make monies available to help pay for the cost of government.
Follow up. It makes more opportunities available than we have currently.
Through the chair, certainly the legislature has opportunities right now to access the permanent fund, but historically they have not chosen to do that. And when I said earlier today we invited you to make other suggestions, there are other ways that could be done to take monies from the realized earnings reserve to help pay for the cost of government.
Thank you. I think what I just heard recognized was that the legislature today does in fact have appropriation authority over the earnings reserve, the unrestricted earnings reserve of the permanent fund, and that would not, had not be changed in any way.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kelly.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, the IRS letter that you talked about, where somebody moving out to drill and wanting to get a predictable ELF, which I think is what you were talking about, can that be undone later by the governor or the legislature?
Through the chair, Representative Kelly, I'm going to turn that over to Dan Dickinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelly, through the chair. There are conditions under which that letter could be changed or, so there is a mechanism laid out and a mechanism to appeal, but the general notion is there'd have to be a reason such as a changed circumstance or in issuing those letters we're able to set out conditions, and if those conditions aren't met, then that letter, the effect of the ruling could be changed.
Thank you.
And if I might just add, I pulled out a 203 book at fiscal year 203, and to Representative Stoltz's question through the chair, the revenues in fiscal year 203 were $2.1 million from the business licenses, and so I think you have very accurately nailed the difference, which is it's approximately a threefold increase. From 2.1 in fiscal year 203 to the 6.5 you see in the current book.
Any other questions?
Yes.
Representative Kelly.
The business part's done. I was just going to ask the commissioner to whom we owe the appreciation for the cartoon on the backside of page 2. That looks like Corbis humor to me, but I don't know that. That's on the retirement of Chuck Logan.
Well, we, through the chair, we're going to miss Chuck, and, but we've got a good man to replace him.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, Commissioner, thank you and your staff for being here. I'm sure we'll have you back before the committee in one form or fashion. And I know that there's still some questions out there about Amaretta Hess and all the issues that are going to relate to that settlement. So I know that one committee member would like to get a little bit more information on it, so maybe you can set up another time, or we'll set up a time to specifically talk about Amaretta Hess.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom Butan is our expert on the subject, and after that, I was just about ready to turn it over to him. So, thank you, and thank you, everybody from Revenue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is a joint federal and state cooperative program that provides health care services and some social service funding as well to needy Alaskans. And the funding actually is found throughout my entire department. We have 8 operating agencies, and virtually every single one of those has some operations around Medicaid. Medicaid is currently insuring about 128,000 Alaskans. We have Medicaid coverage for seniors and for children, for the disabled population. Medicaid pays for services such as skilled nursing care, hospital care, all the way down to some behavioral rehab services that are paid through Medicaid. Those 128,000 people that are currently carrying Medicaid cards contribute to the Medicaid budget, which for fiscal year 2006, for the first time, exceeds $1 billion in total funding. What we have known for a long time is that there is some volatility in the state's match rate. And by match rate, I refer to the amount of our federal Medicaid, amount of our Medicaid program that is financed through federal funds. The large portion of our Medicaid program is financed through federal funds. And there is something called an FMAP, or Federal Medical Assistance Percentage, which is calculated annually using a three-year average of per capita incomes at the state level compared to national per capita incomes to determine whether you are a wealthier state or a poorer state. And if you're a wealthier state, you're asked to bear a larger burden of your Medicaid costs. And if you're a poorer state, you have to bear a lower burden. The lowest amount of federal support any state will receive under the FMAP formula or Medicaid match rate formula is 50%. And the highest amount the federal government will pay, regardless of the per capita income of that state, is 83%. Alaska historically has been a 50-50 state, as it's referred to, or in short, as a state with a higher per capita income, the federal government has capped its participation in the Medicaid program for basic Medicaid claims at 50%. And I don't want to complicate the discussion too much today, except to say that there are some services that are paid for through Medicaid, which we access what are called enhanced Medicaid match rates. So even though our basic Medicaid match rate is set at a certain number, we get a slightly higher federal match rate because these are services that are optional in the Medicaid program, and the Congress has chosen to incentivize states to provide that service. So their way of incentivizing states to provide that service is by agreeing to pay a higher percentage of those charges. Two examples of that are, one is the State Children's Health Insurance Program, which is operated in the state of Alaska under the name of Denali Kid Care. And the second one is the Breast and Cervical Cancer Expansion under Medicaid, which provides services, healthcare services, to women who are diagnosed under a CDC partnership with the state of Alaska to screen low-income women for breast and cervical cancer. They receive an enhanced match rate. We also, for some of our claims under the Indian Health Care Improvement Act, as passed in 1976, we're able to access 100% federal reimbursement for some of our Medicaid claims. And these are claims that are where services are provided to a dual eligible. These are Alaska Natives who are both Medicaid eligible and entitled to receive services through Compact, of course, but through historical IHS-operated facilities. When an Alaska Native Medicaid beneficiary receives their services through, under current CMS interpretation, the four walls of an IHS-operated facility, which for Alaska implies the 638 Native nonprofits who operate tribally operated facilities, we are able to access a 100% Medicaid match rate. So there are some other match rates that are out there in certain circumstances, but the core, the balance of the claims go through at this larger Medicaid match rate. As I said, up until 1997, because of a high per capita income for the state of Alaska, our Medicaid match rate has been 50% federal, 50% state. In 1997, then United States Senator Frank Murkowski proposed legislation and won passage of legislation in the United States Senate and then through Congress and with signature by the President to enhance Alaska's Medicaid match rate for 3 years and to set it at 59.8. Essentially a 9.8% increase. And I think we had a chart that's passed out to sort of explain the history of Alaska's match rate. The governor, working as a senator at that time, of course, argued very persuasively to his colleagues in Washington that the core formula for determining what a Medicaid match rate will be, simply looking at a state's per capita income compared to a national average, is fundamentally flawed, particularly when you apply it to a state such as Alaska. While our per capita income might be incrementally higher than the national average, our cost of providing that care is exponentially higher. And the formula must reflect the actual cost of delivering care, whether that's transportation, labor, supplies, facility construction. It's very expensive to provide services here, and it was strongly argued by then-Senator Frank Murkowski to increase the Medicaid match rate. He won passage of that legislation in 1997. In 2000, that sunsetted. It was a three-year extension. And that three-year extension brought in roughly $100 to $125 million in additional federal funds to help support our healthcare system in the state of Alaska. And that did, to some extent, offset general fund obligations by the state. When that sunsetted, naturally, the problem did not go away. The fundamental underlying formula was still as flawed as it was in 1997. So then working in 2001, then again, still United States Senator Frank Murkowski won passage of another piece of legislation, and this inflated our Medicaid match rate for 5 years, at a sunset of 5 years. And rather than fixing it at a static number, 59.8, rather we put in an adjustment, and I say we because I actually worked on the staff at that time, we put in an adjustment into the Medicaid match rate formula, which was essentially a 5% adjustment on our Medicaid match rate. The result of that, as you can see, is that we were able to maintain an enhanced match rate above what we were going to be entitled to under the underlying flawed formula. That sunsets on October 1st of 2005. And on October 1st of 2005, the beginning of the next federal fiscal year, we revert back to the underlying formulas calculation for the state's Medicaid match rate. The drop is about 7.5 points. We are currently at about 57.5 points. The state's Medicaid match rate will drop down to 50 points. What is causing that is a combination of two things. One piece, as I discussed, is the five-year sunset on the legislation that U.S. Senator Frank Murkowski won passage of. A second piece is that our per capita income has increased compared to the national average over the last couple of years. Well, that's good news. But as a result of that, it has also contributed to this precipitous decline in our Medicaid match rate. We also had, while it's not affecting us completely going into the next federal fiscal year, you will see a decline after the initial adjustment in 2001 going into 2002. And what that derived from was the Bureau of Economic Analysis in Washington, which determines the formula for per capita income. They began changing the way we calculate per capita income for the nation and began including income, employer contributions to employee retirement plans as income earned that year for employees, even though the income would not actually be realized until that person retired and began to receive benefits from their deferred compensation plan. That change in Western states, particularly in large states with a large federal presence, land states, where we have a large number of federal state employees, large number of federal employees who have access to the Thrift Savings Plan, for example, which is the federal equivalent of 401k, employer contribution being the federal government, we more than most other states saw this increase in our per capita income because of this new way we calculate per capita income. So you've seen some volatility over the years because of some administrative changes, but the big change comes on October 1 of 2005. At that point, absent any change in statute in Washington, our Medicaid match rate would drop back down to slightly over 50%, and in out years go back to a 50-50 match rate. What that means in real dollars is important. For FY 2006, such an adjustment, when extrapolated over our Medicaid claims from the current match rate to the projected match rate, would mean in 06, $53 million in federal funding that would be pulled out of the system. In FY 2007, it would be $73 million that would be pulled out, and it would be a little bit more flat after that. The reason you see that jump between 06 and 07 is because of the overlap of state and federal fiscal years. We would only have essentially three quarters of a federal fiscal year impacting our 06 budget year, whereas in state fiscal year 2007, we would have four full calendar quarters under the new Medicaid match rate. We as an administration have been working with our congressional delegation, with Senators Lisa Murkowski and Ted Stevens and Congressman Young, working for a statutory fix for this problem. The problem hasn't gone away. Our formula is still discriminatory towards the state and the high cost of doing business. Senator Murkowski in particular argued passionately in that last year as she worked to fix it last session. We are going to be working with our congressional delegation in the next few months as session begins to really start to percolate back in Washington and to get this fixed before the closeout of the budget cycle that they're debating in Washington this year. And that is why the administration has chosen not to fund this gap through the governor's budget submission for 2006. It's our intention to seek a remedy to this projected shortfall through congressional action, but it does create a liability going into 2006. If Congress is unsuccessful in fixing this error in the Medicaid match rate, it does create a situation where our program operations will be in excess of a projected appropriated amount under the governor's budget submission of about $53 million. Mr. Chairman, that's kind of a rough overview of the situation right now.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Hawker.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of points of clarification and frankly, some things. I'm not quite sure I've even got the answer straight in my head. But, the Lewis and Lawson FMAP percentage, we're looking at a coming up in October. Mm-hmm. Is Alaska the only state affected by that, or are there other states impacted?
Every year, in the Federal Register, there's the publication of the upcoming Medicaid match rates. They change every year. And so going into the next federal fiscal year, there will be some states who will see theirs go up and some will see theirs go down. Some states right now are still experiencing a temporary adjustment for fiscal relief to states that are expiring. So some of them will see a modest 1 or 2 point drop. Alaska by far bears the greatest FMAP reduction of 7.5 points. I don't have the list in front of me. We'll provide it to the committee. I believe the second most affected state negatively is Wyoming, and their drop is a little over 3 points. But the remainder of the states will see their fluctuation normally between none to two. And this is an unprecedented reduction in federal support for a state Medicaid program, a program that is at its construction is a partnership between the state and the federal government.
Representative Hawker.
So Alaska's really at the vanguard of this issue, but it sounds like, this is my point, we do already have other states that would be in alliance with us on wanting to pursue this issue congressionally. It's not just Alaska against the other 49.
Right. Responding to the chair, Representative Hawker, I know a number of governors from the National Governors Association have been meeting with the administration this week in Washington and Congress. There are a number of states who are looking at ways to fix the problem. Right now, Alaska is the only state in the union that has a state-specific adjustment, such as the one that Governor Murkowski won in 2001. But there are a number of states who are seeing reductions, and there certainly is effort both individually through our delegation and nationally through a variety of states to prevent this reduction, which is to some extent it's a cost shift to the states to cover the high cost of care, which is not addressed in the underlying formula, which looks solely at per capita income, not at the cost of delivering healthcare services. A number of studies have been done, just for the education of the committee, looking at healthcare costs. And Alaska, when you look at the cost for an inpatient bed day, if you look at the cost of a daily rate for a skilled nursing facility, we are the most expensive state for delivering healthcare services across the nation. And that's not reflected at all in the federal formula.
Representative Hawker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could also ask, for benefit of all of us, frankly, could you give us a succinct, and I know that's always a challenge, but a succinct definitional difference between terms that are floated around a lot, but they're quite different in substance, and that would be FMAP, as you've described, fair share, and pro share.
Okay, sure. FMAP is the Federal Medical Assistance Percentage, Sponsor Chair of Senator Hawker, and deals solely with determining the ratio of Medicaid costs that are borne by the state and by the federal government. It is determined by looking at a three-year rolling average of states' per capita income, comparing it to the national average of per capita income during that time period, determining who is a wealthier state, who is a poorer state on this fairly arbitrary mechanism, and then determining your Medicaid match rate off of that ratio. With the ceiling being 83% federal support and the floor being 50% federal support. Fair share is a plan developed by the state of Alaska in 2001, about the year. It's a state plan amendment that was submitted to then HCFA, but now CMS, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which is the agency that oversees Medicare and Medicaid for the federal government under Health and Human Services. It was a state plan amendment to the Medicaid state plan to allow for permissive intergovernmental transfers of funds through an enhanced Medicaid match payment to tribally operated facilities. And the intergovernmental transfer was designed to help support state operations. That plan went through a deferral, went through a denial, and went through an appeal board stage within HHS, and currently it's being litigated between the state of Alaska and Health and Human Services through the Ninth Circuit, and that is actually ongoing at this moment. ProShare is a fairly small financial amount, and that deals with some permissive intergovernmental transfers. An intergovernmental transfer is when you have a government-owned, operated, or a local government contributing to help pay the state's share of the Medicaid match. So if you have a claim going through the system where you have a portion of it that's federal dollars, a portion of it that's state dollars, It is perfectly permissible under current regulations for local governments to help support and join their dollars with state dollars to pay the state match. The intergovernmental transfer under ProShare is an arrangement in which locally community-owned hospitals, such as the hospitals you see throughout Southeast Alaska that are public facilities, where they share a portion of the cost of the Medicaid match claim. ProShare, I think in its total amount, is probably barely pushing $1 million right now.
Public ProShare,
which is very small. And though a resident of didn't ask it all, I'll add one more to the list, which is private ProShare. And private ProShare is an approved state plan amendment that was submitted by the state of Alaska to CMS. CMS has approved the state plan amendment in which we do make enhanced payments to our private health care system, and our private health care system in return has utilized the funds to expand their services to get into community wellness issues, such as taking on some funding responsibility for behavioral health grants, for example. And that did go through a deferral during the last calendar year. However, we were notified by CMS last fall in a letter from Secretary Thompson that the deferral was being rescinded and the dollars were being released to the state of Alaska. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you, sir. Very well done.
Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple things, and I don't want to dive into the budget yet. There'll be another time and place for that. But you mentioned the FMAP and the possible change of going from 57% to 51%. Does next year's budget reflect that decrease, or did we budget at 57%?
Mr. Chairman, as I stated, the governor's budget submission in 2006 does not include the funding for the what is currently projected withdrawal of federal support for the state's Medicaid program. It is our intention, it's our belief, that we are going to work cooperatively with our congressional delegation, with other partners, to get this fixed legislatively in Washington before the impact hits. It does, as I stated, create risk, though, in our fiscal year 2006. The risk scenario is if there, for a variety of reasons, a reason could simply be Congress is unable to pass a bill, a larger overarching bill, which this would be included within. If Congress is unable to pass a bill this year to fix the Medicaid match rate for the state of Alaska and for other states who share this problem, we would have a situation where our Medicaid program would be an operation spending $53 million more than the actual amount of receipts will support.
If I may, Mr. Chairman? So, yeah, $53 million is a pretty big risk. So if they aren't able to come through for us, is that something you can eat in your budget next year?
It's not. Sponsor chair, I cannot. The administration is not proposing that. The administration's position is that we'll submit a supplemental request for those dollars.
That's kind of what I figured. Just want to see your reaction to the joke.
I've got a big appetite.
Also, you know, I've heard from people, and you know, I've talked about this, that we're very generous up there with our Medicaid payments in the state of Alaska, but how do we compare with other states nationally?
Well, Medicaid rates, which is the amount we pay the providers, are fairly high. For facilities, we pay based on cost, and we do cost reports. The facilities submit their cost reports because they also bill a variety of insurance programs, including Medicare, which is the federal health insurance program the state does not administer for seniors over the age of 65 and some disabled individuals. They submit cost reports, and those are audited, and we audit them as well, and we base our rate off of the audited cost reports for services we pay. Our rates are high, going out to providers, and those typically reflect the higher cost of doing business in the state of Alaska. When you look at our eligibility standards, you really look at three areas where the state has authority over its Medicaid program. There are some optional services, so there are things that the state covers that doesn't have to cover, but we do cover. Those are optional services. Second area is optional eligible categories. Who are we going to cover that is in excess of federal mandate? And then the rates. I discussed the rates briefly. Around optional services, I think we probably fall in the middle. We could certainly get information from the committee of the list of optional services, which ones we offer, which ones we don't. But there is a collection of optional services that many people really don't deem in the healthcare community as optional, such as technically prescription drugs are an optional Medicaid service. You can provide a Medicaid program and not cover prescription drugs. But certainly modern healthcare practice says that prescription drugs are a core component of healthcare. So we fall somewhere in the middle. Around eligibility, I think we fall somewhere in the middle as well, though in some populations we're probably higher. Where we really stand as an outlier around waivers, particularly around home and community-based waivers. And then you get into billing around personal care attendant services and a couple other programs that are alternatives to traditional Medicaid. We have very generous programs. Some states cap the amount of benefit you can receive from a home and community-based waiver. They'll cap it at the rate that they'll pay at a long-term care facility. So in short, if you're waivered costs, you're trying to keep this person out of an institution, you're paying for a wraparound portfolio of services through waivered care. Some states say that if your costs go above what we pay as a state for nursing home care, that's where we cap our services at. We don't do that. And there are some other areas where we exceed. I think where you'll see the greatest enhancement in Alaska's program over others is in these alternative ways of delivering care. We're an outlier when it comes to home and community-based waivered services.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, again, don't want to get into the budget here too much, but one of the other optional programs that the governor has proposed is the senior care program.
Mm-hmm.
And that, if I understand, that's kind of a continuation of the drug program we have going now. You could maybe you can explain that to me, and then also explain we're basing this on 300% poverty, which I think is 35,000. Is that correct? And maybe you could just say how you obtained that figure, just briefly.
Sure.
I'm really getting off, Mr. Chairman. Sorry.
No,
you're not.
Okay.
Senior care. The governor didn't. Well, actually, this legislature, not this one, but the last session. Passed the initial senior care bill submitted by the governor, in which we began an effort of providing supplemental assistance to seniors for prescription drug expenses. That program is due to expire on January 1 of 2006. And as the governor announced a little over a month ago, and restated in the State of the State speech, he will be submitting legislation this session to enhance the senior care program. The bulk of it is actually outside of Medicaid. It's not a Medicaid benefit. What his proposal will do are three things. The first is to ensure that there's not a single senior in this state who doesn't have access to a prescription drug benefit once the Medicare drug benefit begins, simply because they can't afford the premium or they can't afford their deductible. And so the proposal the governor has put forward is to set at 300% of poverty a line in which if a senior falls below 300% of poverty, the state of Alaska will pay the premium and the deductible costs for that senior who chooses to sign up for the Medicare prescription drug benefit. The Medicare drug benefit begins in January of 2006. It's called Part D. There are different parts to Medicare. Part A normally pays for a lot of your inpatient healthcare services. Part B pays for seniors when they go to their doctor or outpatient services. This is a simplification, of course. Part C deals with Medicare managed care, which we don't have in Alaska. And Part D is this new prescription drug benefit. Each one of those pieces have their own deductible, at least A, B, and D, their own separate deductible. And Part B has its own premium. Seniors are paying that right now when they're in Medicare. When they enroll in Part D, they're going to have another premium. So the governor's proposal is to pay the Part D premium and the Part D deductible for seniors below 300% of poverty who are not already receiving comprehensive, if they have out-of-pocket expense, other comprehensive insurance coverage. Also in senior care are two other pieces. One is an enhancement to our adult protective services. That will not be in the legislation, but that's something that's included in the governor's FY06 budget, but part of a senior care proposal, which is to enhance our adult protective services in the state through staffing increases. And the third piece is a separate piece of legislation in concert with the Mental Health Trust Authority, where we'll add an optional service to Medicaid in which we will cover preventative dental health care or oral health care services for seniors. Currently, we only cover emergency dental services under Medicaid for seniors and for adults on Medicaid. Essentially, if the tooth is so bad, you have to show up at the emergency room and get it extracted, we'll pay for it. But if it's routine preventative services to keep you out of that stage, we don't pay for it. So the governor's proposal is to pay for preventative oral health care services as well, which is an optional Medicaid expansion. So those three components are rolled into the senior care proposal. The question is, why do we pick the 300% line for, and I think the answer simply is because it's the right thing to do.
That's a good answer, Mr. Chairman. And I understand that we're going to have a more in-depth
we'll be about this program sometime in the future.
It's all the schedule, and we'll just have to get everything set up within the department.
Okay.
Representative Kelly.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, do you have any downstream programs that look at trying to have some hand, as you might, in getting the people off of this that ought to be off of this, or do you just hand out the checks based on how the person is doing currently?
Responding to the chair, Representative Kelly. First of all, we don't hand out checks under Medicaid.
I understand.
This is a benefit. We work aggressively in our department throughout all of our programs to promote self-sufficiency. It's a sort of embedded philosophy that I take seriously, our staff takes seriously, that first and foremost, as a department, all of our programs are designed to promote self-sufficiency. What do we have to wrap around this person to either fix a crisis that exists in that family at this time, a deficiency perhaps in substance abuse problem, or job training skills, because we also run public assistance for the state of Alaska. What do we have to do to wrap services around this family quickly, efficiently, and responsibly to build this family up, get them back to work, let them be productive, and become self-sufficient, because we don't exist to provide long-term support for individuals. Our second philosophy, however, is that for some people, they're not going to become self-sufficient. We know that. Obviously, because of a great disability or some other event in that family, they may not become self-sufficient and may always rely on some services. So this administration does support maintaining a strong safety net, but it's a backstop. It's a backstop after all of our efforts are devoted towards self-sufficiency and have not been successful. And our third effort that we've been working for in the department is how do we address, particularly in rural Alaska, the access issues, the underserved issues. And so those are things we're working on in the department. Around movement to self-sufficiency, I look at our public assistance caseload. And we do have many individuals who receive their Medicaid services based on their eligibility for other programs, such as cash assistance benefits. We've been very successful in moving aggressively to try to move people off of welfare programs into work, into jobs provided for their families. I look at our welfare caseload. In 1996, the welfare caseload was almost 13,000 families. We've dropped that down by 58%. We're now down to under 6,000 families who are on public assistance benefits right now. Just in this last year alone, I think it's one of our success stories of this last fiscal year, we're kind of finishing up, we've dropped our caseload by another 9%.
Thank you.
And we're moving aggressively to move people towards self-sufficiency and a job.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Janet, for being here today. We won't have a meeting on Monday, but Tuesday we'll have a presentation from Northwest Cruise Ship Association. Wednesday, an overview on the senior health care. And Thursday, overview of the Office of Children's Services. So unless there's any other business to come before the committee, we'll adjourn and call it a day. Thank you.
Yeah, we